At Quite the Thing Media, we aim to bring you the best podcasts produced by independent creators, made without constraints.
Podcast Father here. Join me on my journey as I start out as the indie podcaster.
You've been searching for a podcast. Want to know about some great artist? Yeah. You've come to the right place. Indie Podcaster with your host, the Podcast Father.
I'm excited for this episode of Indie Podcaster. I'm your host, Jeff, aka Podcast Father. Mike Zago is with me. He's got a podcast. He is back. He is still here, hanging in.
Oh yeah.
Your podcast, The Link, a podcast with Mike Zago. Make sure everybody checks that out. But Mike, today, on a serious note, this interview was with Clara Santamol, Final Days on Earth podcast. It is about the mysterious death of Damien Hirst. Controversial story, in my opinion, that everybody, I'm not going to say will enjoy, because that kind of sounds crappy, right? But we'll be intrigued. And
it's definitely intriguing and captivating.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. And after you're done hearing this interview, you're going to want to know more. It will get you hooked.
Big time.
And she's super cool, Claire. She is actually works for 48 hours and has all sorts of awesome credentials, but she did this podcast on her own as a side project. So that shows a lot of dedication and work that went into it.
It's incredible. Investigative journalists in general are so awesome to me. There's something romantic about that life. The ability to get so deep into a thing. It's almost like if you watch Always Sunny in Philadelphia, the Pepe Sylvia scene. It's hilarious. He's got like corkboard full of insane theories and connections and all that. But there's something so relatable and cool about diving that deep into something. I can't even walk from one room to the other without forgetting what the hell I went in there for. But it seems like she is able to keep this super straight, and it just dives hard into the details and it unfolds more theories. And it's just super interesting.
Yo, it is. And she was, I think it was the second person this interview, spoiler alert, was actually the second one I did. So I am by no means a great interviewer. Maybe that's what makes it work. I don't have a script. Hell, I couldn't have the time to write one if I wanted to.
It's authentic.
Authentic. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, check out this interview. You're going to love it. Before we get to that interview, though, I'm going to share a little business. Myself and this podcast are proud members of Quite the Thing Media. Make sure you're checking out Quite the Thing Media. Go to quitethethingmedia.com. If you want to go to my personal site, it's actually at Quite the Thing Media, quitethethingmedia.com/podcastfather. There you can request to be on this podcast as a guest. Also, a review from me on site. Make sure you're checking out all the great original podcasts on site and the independent creators on site, quitethethingmedia.com. Couldn't do this podcast without the hosting platform, Captivate FM. Captivate FM is great, guys. I can't tell you how great it is. I could talk about it all day, but I will tell you one thing. For me, as a new podcaster, it's amazing. There's all sorts of tools, growth labs, etc. The team is so hands-on at Captivate FM, they will help you through your journey. If you're a podcaster or content creator, you want to distribute your stuff, go to CaptivateFM.com. They'll go ahead and give you 7 free days off the bat, but I'll tell you what, if you go to my Quite the Thing Media page, quitethethingmedia.com/podcastfather, there at the bottom, you'll find an affiliate link. You can get 30 days of Captivate FM free. Why wouldn't you check it out? Captivate FM. This podcast is sponsored by Good Pods, my great friends at Good Pods. This is an amazing app, guys. You get on there, you see what podcast your friends and influencers are listening to. Download the Good Pods app. All the music on this podcast is from the artist Young Karts. Young Karts, great independent artist. You got to check out all the work. Go to the site, youngkartsbeats.com. If you want to contact me, you can find me on Twitter at podcast_father, or the podcast actually has an account too, at indie_podcaster, or good old fashioned email, always great too, thepodcastfather@gmail.com. You want to support this podcast? One great way you can do for me is you can go on your favorite podcast listening platform, may that be an Apple or Good Pods, and give me a rating, throw me a 5-star, type some nice things to me. If you don't even want to type, don't worry about it. Just throw me some stars. Any feedback is appreciated. I really do appreciate it. If you want to get real crazy and support me, you can always buy me a coffee. Check it out on my Quite the Thing Media page. That's enough for the business. Let's get to the view. Claire is with me here. I'm going to let you tell a little bit about yourself to the listeners.
Great. So my name is Claire Sanema, and I'm the host of Final Days on Earth. And it's my first podcast, and it's an investigative podcast that the entire season is devoted to one case, and that is the story of Damien Hurd.
I've been binge listening to this, and it's an incredible story that has so many questions unanswered. But before we get into all that, tell us about you and your history, you know, as a journalist, as everything leading up to this, your career and education, all that.
Sure. So I have been, you know, in journalism since 2010. I started out, you know, in a local newspaper as a local reporter, print reporter, which was always my dream, working for a community newspaper at the time called People Newspapers. And it was there that I got the crime bug. I didn't see it coming at all, but I was doing the police blotter every week. And anybody who's ever worked in local journalism knows that that's part of the bread and butter of your first kind of cub reporter job, going through the police blotter and finding interesting crimes and writing them up. And so I got interested because I realized that crime stories are the well that never runs dry. And when your editor's like, you know, what stories do you have for me? You don't have to be too enterprising to come up with crime stories. They're actually written in black and white. You know, the headline at least is written for you, and you can go dig into it and write, you know, as in-depth as you want to about a crime. And so I started kind of covering crime for that community newspaper, even though that wasn't technically, you know, what I was hired to do. But I got on it, and one thing led to another, and I ended up covering my first trial. It was about a sexual assault case, teacher accused of sexual assault of a student. And, you know, that actually went, it turned into a big story and became something that launched a new phase of my career. And I was recruited to be the managing editor of a daily news website that was just coming to Dallas called Culture Map. And so they had read my reporting on that case and asked me to come interview for the job. And so I started working for them. And that was like in 2012. So I did that for a couple of years and did some enterprise reporting there about a home invasion that was actually a faked home invasion where a woman had killed her husband while he slept in bed, had staged a home invasion. And that was the case of Michelle Williams and Greg Williams. And so I did a whole deep dive on her and her background and all these various cons and mysterious deaths that surrounded her. And that got the attention of the big crime shows. And 48 Hours on CBS ended up contacting me about doing a story on that case. And so I became an on-air consultant for them. For the Michelle Williams case. From there, I just started working for 48 Hours. I pitched them on the idea of me being a field producer based in Dallas, finding crime stories all around Texas for them. And I've been doing that since 2014.
That's awesome. And how did we come across in touch paths? Obviously I saw the submission and I was like, oh, well, I got to look into this, but how did you happen to find me, I guess?
Yeah. So through the Damien Hurd podcast, through Final Days on Earth, you know, I've created all new like social media accounts just for the podcast. And so I'm, you know, pretty well established as Claire Sanema, 48 Hours producer, you know, have a big following online in that capacity. But when I was doing the podcast, I really wanted to start fresh because I wanted to find people who just wanted to know about the podcast, who wanted to know about Damien Hurd. It's kind of been fun to be like reborn on the internet and and be in a whole new space and be, you know, fresh, like a rookie again is how I feel. And so I've gone deep into podcast Twitter. And I love it. It's my favorite kind of Twitter. And I came across you there. You were, I don't remember exactly how, but you were tweeting something out that I thought was interesting. And I liked your avatar as the podcast father. And so I was like, I just see what this guy's up to. And, you know, followed the click rabbit hole for a while. And then I saw you had a place for submissions. And I was like, oh, I'd love to talk to this guy. Hopefully he wants to talk to me. Let's see.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you did because I'm honestly a sucker and obsessed with true crime. When I saw your submission, the first thing I did was actually not listen to the podcast. listen to a dozen of them a day, but I actually instantly started researching it. And there's a lot of stuff about it. I saw the 48 hours. I haven't got to watch it yet. There's not much out there on video except for the 48 hours. I thought that was interesting. You can find a lot of news stories, but video-wise, special-wise, it seems like it's just been contained to that.
I was not personally involved with that episode, but I'm very familiar with the case because I, you know, like you, find it fascinating and horrifying and one of the more, you know, disturbing, long-lived true crime stories out there. You should check out In the Dark by Michelle McNamara if you haven't already.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. And did you see the HBO did a special? I think it's called the same. I think it's also called In the Dark. Or All Be Gone in the Dark or something?
All Be Gone in the Dark.
Yeah.
That's what he said when he left that house. Yeah.
Woohoo. Yeah.
That stuff was just so, it just make the hair stand up on your neck. And this for me was this case that, you know, with Damien Hurd, is just so interesting because there's, like I said earlier, there's so many questions I think that everybody has. And this podcast is typically like the theme that I'm setting out here just to highlight individual creators, some more established than others, obviously. But for me, it's also about highlighting things like this as well. So this is why I'm really excited. A lot of people listening won't hear about this because, hell, I didn't hear about it somehow. I feel crazy not hearing about it. So I'll let you just take a second to talk about Damien Hurd. And where was it in Texas where he was from?
So he was from Fort Worth, Texas, is the best big city reference. He grew up in Azle, which is a very small town, a suburb of Fort Worth. But he went to Fossil Ridge High School in Fort Worth and was a state champion wrestler his senior year, you know, won that state title, very well known in the wrestling community, you know, just a huge name, a small guy, but a huge name.
I will say this, when I YouTubed the name, I was expecting several news stories about his death and disappearance. And what I mostly got was all these amazing wrestling videos from him in high school. Yeah, he was a heck of a wrestler.
Yeah, he was a beast. You know, the videos I've seen, some of the matches, you know, only last a few seconds before he pins somebody and wins. So yeah, he was definitely a force to be reckoned with and, you know, has left a big mark on the wrestling community in Texas and, you know, throughout the nation. So Damien went to college in 2014. He was a freshman wrestler at Western Colorado University in Gunnison. He goes to a party with his teammates on a Saturday night, and he's never heard from again. That is really the essential nugget of the story that won me over. The idea that he's this young kid, popular, he's got friends, he's doing well in school, he's got plans for the future. He goes off to a party and has no idea it's the last night of his life. His body is found 4 days later by the police, and there are so many questions at that point. How did he end up, you know, where his body's found? Is this remote area? His car's there. It's looks like it's been ransacked. Every item in the car has been turned over. You know, there's a package that's been ripped open. The contents are missing. It's a very curious scene. His cell phone's disassembled. So there's just lots of questions that were created by the discovery of his body. A lot of times when a body is found, that's the end of the story. For Damien, you know, it was really just beginning.
What year did you come in on all this? Because this happened in 2014. What year did you come in? Did you actually physically go down there and interact? Because this would have been before the pandemic. So did you actually get to go down there and meet his father and all these individuals?
So in 2014, when this happened, I was working at Culture Map and I covered it as a breaking news story, a crime story, you know, local Fort Worth boy goes off to college and dies under mysterious circumstances in Colorado. And so I interviewed his father at the time, and his father was here in Texas. So I went to, he actually had a wrestling fundraiser benefit. And so I went to that at Fossil Ridge High School and met his dad and some of his other coaches and friends there and did my first reporting on the story back in 2014, shortly after it happened. And I started just collecting information and documents and whatever I could get my hands on at that time. But I didn't actually start working on the podcast until 2018. I think my first trailer was 2019 that I got it out. You know, it took a lot longer than I imagined it would. I think I was a little naive about how long it would take to make a good podcast that I was ready to put out and put my name on and everything. But yeah, and then in 2020, believe it or not, I actually do go to Colorado. I go to Gunnison. I road tripped there. My husband and I rented a car and drove, and we camped and everything. You know, it was such a crazy time. It didn't seem like, you know, a lot of people were like, oh, you can't go now. But I was like, man, if not now, when, you know, and everything I wanted to see practically was outdoors. So I was like, you know, I feel like I can go do this and I should go do this. And so we went in the summer of 2020 to Gunnison and did some on-location reporting and fact-finding.
Going back to the dynamic of the story, so the thing that really sticks out to me is, and it's not a common scenario, that just the father is the one mostly in the public speaking for his son. They must have had a very, 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 and it seems like they did, close relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. They were very close. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, because I, as a 48 Hours producer, all the stories I do involve death. And so something that happens a lot with death is that people romanticize the person after they're gone. And so it's something that I have a sensitivity to. I understand that's a natural reaction, but I try not to fall into that trap because every human being, you know, has faults. Everyone, there's no perfect person. And so with Damien's story, when his father came out and was talking about how close they were, I was immediately suspicious of that, to be honest, that they really were that close. But through my reporting and through, you know, his conversations with his friends, and I got his cell phone records and everything, I mean, he really was that close with his dad. He talked to his dad every day. That's a rare thing, you know, in this world. And I think it's something that has given his dad a lot of comfort. You know, they didn't have, you know, but 20 years together, but my goodness, did they make the most of it? You know, I mean, he can't regret a single day because he talked to his son every day, you know, and that's really one of those things that, you know, sticks out to me about this story, just that they had that special relationship. And there's nothing that will bring Damien back, but, you know, whenever you look at things that happened during his life and you believe, you know, that they made the most of the time that they had, I think that that's something that gives, you know, him some measure of comfort, just knowing that, you know, they had that close of a relationship for a reason. You know, some people get 60 years with their dad, some people get 10, you know, and so you don't know how long you have, and it makes people appreciate the relationships in their lives, you know, all that much more.
And it's got to be hard from, like you said, an emotional standpoint. You actually want to get invested in it to a certain extent, right? But you don't want to let that consume you from the investigative piece of it. So I'm sure that's a challenge.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, in the beginning, and 2014 is whenever I was making the transition from working at Culture Map Dallas and being the managing editor and covering a variety of stories and managing people on staff and a large freelance, you know, community that we had writing for us, to working for 48 Hours and becoming a producer for them and doing all murder cases all the time. And it was a huge, you know, just emotional shift, because what I did as the managing editor of a daily news website was largely not keeping me up at night. You know, it was not the kind of thing haunting my dreams. But whenever I started working at 48 Hours, and every case that we look at, you know, is so complicated and tragic and unexpected. You know, we don't do the drug dealer killed on the corner. You know, we don't do the gang violent, the kind of stuff that you can understand that is still tragic and it's terrible, but, you know, it makes sense. And you think, well, that couldn't happen to me, or that's not any like anyone I know. The stories that 48 Hours does, and the Damien Heard case as well, it's a story where you can really see, you know, sympathy with characters, and you can feel, gosh, how did this happen? And you know, it's the kind of stuff that does keep you up at night. I feel like I've gotten better at separating, you know, a healthy level of compartmentalization is definitely something in my toolkit that I've gotten better at using. But yeah, in the beginning, I would get super, you know, just emotionally attached to the cases and the characters. And
this would have been near the completion of his freshman year, right?
He went there in 2013. I think earlier I said 2014, but he graduated, you know, in 2013, and then went there over the summer to do the summer wrestling camp and to get acclimated to the altitude, because it's a big difference.
Oh yeah. You know, especially athletically. I mean, that's
exactly.
A,
yeah. Yeah, so that was a big part of it, that he needed that time to adjust to the altitude before wrestling season started, and just really get comfortable living up there. And so he went there, you know, like in June 2013 and started his freshman year in the fall. And then this all occurred March 29th, 2014. So it was the second semester, his freshman year.
Long story short, he ends up at a party, which is the wrestling captain or the wrestler's kind of house where some of them live. And a lot of it's just swept under the rug because he was kind of a feisty guy that got in some scruffles with even people that considered him a friend. But I mean, that's kind of, in my opinion, that's kind of normal for a 19-year-old male is that physically dominant and that his competitive spirit. But he goes to this party, and there's a lot of different stories about what happened at this party and the timeline of everything. So what were some of those? I mean, I know that somebody saw him sleeping on the couch around, it was 2 a.m.
Yeah, so the timeline is the most fascinating part of this case because there are so many different accounts of it. Now, we have certain fixed points that we know for sure what Damien was doing at what time, but there's huge gray areas and there's lots of inconsistencies and conflicting statements. So we know he goes to the wrestler's party, you know, he gets there and stays there like around 8 p.m., you know, before he went to the party, he definitely went to an off-campus apartment and purchased LSD. And so that ends up playing a pretty large role in the police investigation later on. So he purchases this LSD before going to the party. He goes to the party. And while at the wrestler's party, he is in the mix of everything, right?
Yeah.
He's talking to girls, he's taking pictures, he's Snapchatting, he's inviting everyone to this party. He is sending the address to tons of people. Come party, you know, just sometimes he just sends the address. He also sends a text message to a guy named Anthony Rios, who is a member of the cross country team who had just started dating Damien's ex-girlfriend.
A rival.
Absolutely. A member of a different sports team and also a romantic rival for the girl that he still had feelings for, most people would tell you. So he sends him a text message of the address to the wrestler's house, which is not unlike a text message that he sent to many other people. But after sending Anthony this text message with the wrestler's house address, then he writes, "If you down." And so those words have launched, you know, tons of theories about why he sent that and what he meant. Was this just a friendly invitation to the party like he had sent to dozens of other people? Or was this actually an invitation to fight? Because whenever Anthony shows up at the party, the general consensus, everyone's account, Damien and Anthony begin to fight almost immediately. And so they have a very quick but very violent encounter outside the wrestler's house. And they're separated by their various team captains. Captain of the cross-country team, whose name's Sam Vandeveld, he pulls Anthony off. And then Kyle Pyatt, the captain of the wrestling team, he pulls Damien off. And so they kind of go to their separate corners, the cross-country team, you know, in one area, and Damien and the wrestlers in another. That fight between Damien and Anthony is over. This is around 11 p.m. That's over. As far as we know, they don't fight again. But then the wrestlers themselves really get on to Damien for picking this fight.
I do want to take another second here to talk about the sponsor of this podcast, Good Pods. Like I mentioned earlier in the intro, you can see what podcasts your friends and influencers are listening to. This app is great, and the creators and team Good Pods are very serious about making you the greatest listening experience for a podcast. Not only just the quality of the audio listening piece, but also the social aspect. This is a really awesome app. I can't suggest it enough. I'm very involved in there. They're very dedicated to podcasters, independent podcasters, and listeners. I have a couple groups on there you should go check out. The Indie Podcasters group, highlight indie podcasters, obviously. I've also recently created a true crime group. I'm a big true crime fan. You should join both of those groups. And every week, we do pick podcasts out of the Indie Podcasters group to highlight in the recommended section. But once again, I'll say it again, the Good Pods team is a great team of people. I can personally vouch for them, but they're also dedicated to making this app as good as possible. You can talk to them on social media directly. They will respond. They take all recommendations very serious. There's a great team at Good Pods. Make sure you download the Good Pods app and listen to your podcast there. Let's get back to the interview.
There's various accounts of this.
This is the captain, right? Or the person that lives in this house.
Yeah. So the wrestling house, which, you know, there were four roommates. And so there was Kyle Pyatt, the wrestling captain. There was Elliot Copeland, who was also a member of the wrestling team. Andrew Morris, a member of the wrestling team. And then there was a girl named Courtney Birch that also lived in that house. And she was not a wrestler, but she was just friends with all those guys. And everyone referred to it as the wrestler's house. And so Kyle Pyatt definitely was one of the people involved in the post-fight confrontation with Damian. And then there's varying accounts of the other members of the wrestling team that were involved in that. Zach Shank is a name that comes up pretty regularly. And then we're not quite sure of the other people that might have been involved at that time, but at least Kyle Pyatt and Zach Shank take Damian back into the house. And there's a couple different accounts of this. Again, some people say that that Kyle had put Damian in a headlock and then he was dragging him through the house. Another report is that they, quote, put Damian to sleep, which created, you know, a lot of questions.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, there's a wrestling move called the sleeper hold, mm-hmm. right? So is that what they're talking about? Or is that just, you know, is that a euphemism for they helped him into bed? You know, we don't really know. But the statement that's given to police is that they put Damian to sleep. And so Damian goes off into a back room, is seen with these wrestlers. Some people say, oh yeah, we saw Damian after that. Other people say, I never saw Damian again after he went into that back room with the wrestlers. There's just a lot of confusion. And, you know, it's a party. People are drinking. There's recreational drug use. The timelines are not that reliable. What we know for sure, because we have the actual data to look at, is at 1:36 in the morning, Damian goes to a gas station in Gunnison, about a half mile from the wrestler's house. At this gas station, he's actually wearing an extra large camouflage sweatshirt that belonged to Andrew Morris, one of the wrestlers at the house. And that was the last room that Damian was seen in, was Andrew Morris's room. Somehow he puts on Andrew's sweatshirt, which is many sizes too big for him. Damian was, you know, a small guy. All his clothes that he's wearing are size small, except for this extra large sweatshirt. But he throws that on. He goes and gets gas.
He fills up the tank completely, right?
Well, he fills it up halfway.
Halfway, okay.
So that was interesting because Damian was known to be really conservative with his money. Like, he didn't use a lot of money. Usually he would fill up $5, $10 at a time in his gas tank. And Gunnison's a super small town, so there's not a lot of gas to be used. And Damian was really known for sticking around Gunnison. That was, you know, his place. He didn't go on a lot of excursions. He liked being in Gunnison, and that's, you know, pretty much where he hung out. So the idea that he put $25 worth of gas in his tank at 1:30 in the morning is unusual to his friends, to his dad. It was a lot of gas for Damian to put in his car. He had an SUV, could have held twice that much, but he normally wouldn't want to put all that spending money into his gas tank, you know, when he wouldn't need it for a while. So that was interesting. But he fills up his tank, half a tank of gas, and you see him on the surveillance video. And we were later able to match his ATM debit card purchase to that occasion. And so you see him back into the pump, get out, fill the gas tank, and drive off into the night. And he looks like a completely normal, you know, he doesn't seem nervous or is looking over his shoulder or checking his watch or anything. He just is like a cool customer, calmly filling gas, stands outside the pump while it fills up, and then drives off. And that's the last time that we can actually say that Damian was alive, for sure. There's his digital trail disappears after that. It looks like his cell phone was turned off. People who tried to reach him after that would say it would just go straight to voicemail. And he doesn't have any text messages or any other records on his phone that exist beyond that.
And the next morning, obviously, his friends can't get a hold of him. It's a Sunday, right? And they can't get a hold of him. His dad couldn't get a hold of him. But then again, you I mean, I went to college, right? I mean, I didn't always talk to my dad. I can picture them, a parent thinking, hey, they'll just get a hold of me tomorrow or whenever. So nobody speaks with them on Sunday. Monday rolls around and this is class time, right? And he's not showing up to classes, but there's a little bit of a conflict because he was signed into a class.
See, everyone thought he was showing up to classes, and that's what prolonged this missing persons investigation and what really made it a true mystery, because Damien heard, you know, there's a record of him attending class on Monday after the party and then going to the cafeteria and then going to class again.
Cafeteria, you mean there was he had a card, a student ID card or something that had a hit on it. It was active, right?
Correct. Yeah. His meal plan was used in the cafeteria and two different professors gave email confirmation that he had attended classes. Whenever Damien's dad first calls the university to say, I can't get a hold of my son, I'm trying to track him down. Can you go to his dorm room? Can you, you know, it's unusual. He usually calls me right back. And the first thing they did is they looked up his student ID card and they said, oh, well, he's actually in class. He's in the cafeteria. He's in class again. Like, I don't know why he's not calling you back, but you know, he's not a missing student as far as we're concerned. Had those hits not happened, had his ID card not registered on the system three separate times, I think this case would have ended a lot more quickly because they didn't believe that he was a missing person. But Damien's dad was so confused. They hadn't had some fight. They hadn't had a falling out. Why is his son not talking to him? This makes no sense.
And because they usually talk every day.
Yeah. So, yeah. And he would at least have responded to his text message. Let's say he's cramming for a test or he's hungover or whatever, you know, it can be any end of the spectrum. He would at least text his dad to say he was okay. And that he'd call him later. And he never got a single response despite a volume of communication that he put out on, you know, every different medium he could think of. And so he, Damien's dad, Gary, you know, continued to reach out to friends, to reach out to the university and say, I know you're telling me he's okay, you know, that he's in class, but I can't get a hold of him. And so finally he ends up calling the police department, the Gunnison Police Department on Tuesday. And that's whenever official missing person investigation is started. And so what happened is the police, as soon as, you know, Damien's dad made this report, they said, well, we'll go to the university and we'll get information from them, you know, about where he is. You know, the university initially told them the same thing. We have confirmation of him being in class. And, you know, and so then the police are like, well, we're going to go to his dorm room because his dad's really concerned. So they go knock on his dorm room. And that's whenever the case takes a turn. It's not just, you know, a helicopter dad who can't get a hold of his son, but his son's fine. They get into that dorm room and all of Damien's stuff is there. His backpack, his laptop, you know, all of his clothes. And his roommate's like, yeah, he hasn't been here since Saturday. And this is all Damien's stuff. He hasn't touched any of it. And so the police, you know, they're like, well, this guy's not going to class if all of his stuff's here, you know, and he hasn't been back. And, you know, the roommate's like, no, I haven't seen him. And so then that's whenever the university story really starts to fall apart about him attending class. And it was interesting. I tried really hard to get the university to talk about how they got this information and what they were looking at and, you know, how it was communicated to them. Like, what system were they looking at? Could they show me the records that they had looked at? But they would not do any of that. But what I was able to do is get a copy of an email that they had sent out on Wednesday morning, talking about Damien Hurd being a missing student and how they were trying to verify his class attendance and meal card use. But that's what they had records of on Monday. And they sent out that email on Wednesday morning at 8:45 in the morning. And his body is found that same day at like 10 a.m. And based on the timeline I've been able to create using source documents, police interviews, you know, everything that's official in the case, the university's position only changed after the discovery of Damien's body. I can't find anything that proves otherwise. The best that I can say based on the information I have available is that the university believed that he really was in class and really used his ID card in the cafeteria up until his body was found. And that's the point where they said, we no longer trust that information. We no longer think he was in class. We don't think he was in the cafeteria. And they actually started calling it a mistake. We made a mistake.
Yeah.
And it's never that that's as much clarity as we've ever gotten on it. And it's really the, you know, linchpin of the mystery in the case. Who signed him into class? Who used his meal card in the cafeteria? Because it doesn't seem physically possible that it was Damien, based on, you know, the fact that his body was found on this ridge. And you know, there's an eyewitness that actually saw his body on Sunday and didn't know what she was seeing and didn't make a report of it to the police until Wednesday afternoon, after seeing the, you know, police bulletin that a body had been found at this location. She realized, I had been at that location and I saw something strange, but I didn't know what I was seeing at the time. You know, so she ends up giving this timeline that Damien was there as early as Sunday morning. So it's really interesting.
So the school didn't have it. I mean, this is 2013, 14. It's not, you know, 1980s. I mean, the surveillance, they just didn't have that there from a security system.
They can cross-reference. Yeah, you know, that's an excellent question and something that I tried to get clarity on as well. They claimed that their video camera system did not point at the access points where Damien would have been seen, or whoever used his card would have been seen at that time.
It's where you'd put the cameras at, access point, entry points.
You would think you would have it right on that cash register, right on that meal card swipe, right on the entrance to the cafeteria, on the entrance to, you know,
the school in general,
classrooms. Yeah. I was told, and I know Damien's father asked this as well, and you would think the police department, you know, that would have been part of their investigation, fact checking, pretty basic stuff. You know, where are the video cameras in your university in 2014? Like you said, we were all told that there was no footage that existed.
All the focus is obviously on the timeline being Sunday morning when the body is found. The body is hanging from a tree up on the edge of a cliff or down a cliff, or
it's up on a ridge. So I'm from Texas. Everything's super flat here. So to me, you know, it's a pretty good height. It's a pretty good distance. For Colorado, it's not really, you know, a cliff or a mountain. It's really more of like a hill or a ridge to people in Colorado. But there is some elevation. And from the position where Damien's body was hanging, because I hiked up there, you have a view of like this valley and of the road, of, you know, a pretty busy road. It's so strange to me, the idea that a body could be hanging there for 4 days, three days, and no one reported seeing it.
That's strange. How far?
It is very strange.
How far is this location from the party and then his dorm?
Yeah, so it's about 8 to 10 miles from this, from the campus. It's really strange. It's another one of those like things that you don't know until you go physically to Colorado. But in the police report, they listed the location where his body was found on a different road than he was actually found on. Oh. So they listed it as Bureau of Land Management Road 3106. But when you get there, there's a mile marker and there's a sign marker, and it's Bureau of Land Management Road 3107. So all the initial calculations I did of where he was found was using the wrong road when I just was using Google Maps and trying to recreate it based on police information. It was inaccurate, you know? And so that was interesting to me. One of those things you just can't know till you're there. But the initial police report that was written by a different agency, the Gunnison County Sheriff's Department, they list 3107, which is the correct road.
Who reported to the scene first? This was like this was a county location outside of the city. So is correct. This when the county reported to the...
Yes. So there was a BOLO, a be on the lookout for Damien's car. And he had Texas license plate and he drove a Saturn SUV that, you know, Saturn had been discontinued. They weren't making cars like this anymore. So it was a pretty unique vehicle. And the Texas license plate, for this time of year in Colorado, it's not really a time that a lot of Texans go. So it's unusual. So you would think a car would be found pretty quickly with this type of BOLO going out. And so it wasn't that long. You know, it was the BOLO was like 7 p.m. on that Tuesday, the 1st. And then his car is found 10 a.m. on the 2nd. So, you know, it's a little over 12 hours and the car's found.
How far was the car from the scene?
So the scene itself, where his body is found, is up on this ridge, and the car is found parked outside the gate to Cabin Creek. And at this time of the year, the gate was actually closed. They weren't allowing cars to go down the road. Damien's car is pressed up against the gate, a closed gate, and next to a fence. And he would have had to, you know, get out and maneuver his way around the gate and the fence. Like, you have to really want to get out there. You know, it's not an open trail. You know, so that was interesting too. But his body is found, you know, about 100 feet, I would say, from the car. And again, in the police report, it was listed as 100 yards. And I was like, that's a football field. Like, that's so far. It's big not 100 difference. Yards. It's 100 feet. Yeah, I was like, this is definitely not 100 yards. Big football fan. No way this is a whole, you know, 100-yard field here. So, but it was a considerable distance. And the terrain is not flat. And there's all sorts of bushes and plants and obstacles. And, you know, it's rocky. You know, you don't have sure footing. You know, I almost twisted my ankle just trying to get through it myself. It's not like a leisurely hike or like a place. It looks like little kind of animal trails through there. But the obvious places to hike and bike are further down. Like, this is just going up a fence line to the largest tree in the immediate area. So it really looks like, you know, whoever was there knew that that tree was the closest place to hang something. There's no other tree in the immediate area that would support a noose and hanging. So it's just sort of the largest tree, but not an easy place to get to.
He's not from there. Is there anybody that can vouch for the fact that he's been there before with them, or he hadn't been there for a super long time to know a whole lot of ins and outs, long enough to know somebody associated with you would probably, because you're not from there, somebody had to take you there, show you that place more than likely. I mean, is there anybody that said that they knew that he knew of that location?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Jeff. And those are the questions that I had in my head too. And no one has come forward to say that Damien knew about this location, that he'd been there before, or that they knew him to go there. And that was one of the things whenever I was looking at his cell phone records, I was like, did he ever go here? Did he ever take pictures there? Did someone send him a text message with this address? Because there's a mile marker and there's an easy way to pinpoint where this is. And to me, that's the only way you'd find it. Like, whenever I went there, it's like I almost missed it coming from campus. I mean, it's super hard to find. You don't see it. And the entrance is actually coming from the opposite direction. Like, if you're coming from Texas or something, you would come up on the right side of it to go right in. But coming from campus to the Cabin Creek location, it's very hard to find. And you really have to know it's there, especially at night. So that's always been a big question mark for me. The biggest questions with the investigation that I hope my podcast will answer is, who signed Damien into class? How was his card used in the cafeteria? And is there a connection to Cabin Creek, to Damien, or to anyone that he knew? Because, you know, I know from my crime reporting that the locations of a suicide is typically a place with some kind of connection to the person. You know, there's always exceptions to everything, but the vast majority of cases, a suicide will have, the location will have a personal meaning to the victim. And that's also true of homicides. Where someone is killed, where a body is dumped, always, almost always has a connection to the killer. Killer very rarely will dump a body in an unknown location. So to me, those connections are key, whether it's Damien or someone else. The idea that the Cabin Creek location is a complete shot in the dark, a complete anomaly, not known to anyone prior to this event, I put that in the smallest likelihood of possibilities.
And it gets a little bit more strange, and we're obviously going to touch up on everything, but the car is locked up. When the car is discovered, it's locked, right?
Yes.
And like you said earlier, it's a mess. Looks like it's been ransacked by somebody, whether it's him or not, we don't know.
Right.
And then when you get to the location of where he's found, there's a lot of strange things that happen there. I hope I'm not messing any of it up. The weird thing that stuck out to me is there's a sleeping bag found nearby.
Yes.
Which, you know where my mind goes. It's not easy to move 120 pounds, no matter how strong. I mean, there's some strong people in college athletics, so there's other ways to assist with that. And that's really what stuck out to me. So then the body itself and the stuff he's wearing just doesn't seem like it's being worn right. His pants aren't even buttoned, right?
Right.
Shoes not tied, but correct. The pants part is strange because it doesn't make any sense. Why would they be unbuttoned? And he's actually found what he has the flannel on that you talked about that was the other guy's, Andrews. And that's how he's found even hood up, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. And I go into really close detail into all these items and their possible meanings in actually my 10th episode. And we talk about possibilities for the sleeping bag, one of which is the one that you mentioned that I'm partial to as well, that it was used to carry a body. I've seen suitcases that a body was transported in, golf bags, giant Rubbermaid containers. People will use whatever they have around them to transport a body to make it easier, because a dead body is dead weight and it's extremely difficult to move a dead body. So the sleeping bag, to me, I agree, that thought had crossed my mind. Now, the official police position is that Damien himself carried that sleeping bag up there and used it for comfort as he was committing suicide. So that's what they believe to them. You know, it was his item. It was his sleeping bag. It was found in his car. It was known to be in his car. And the idea that it was there, the police believe, fits with their theory of suicide. So that's always been interesting to me, because I just think it's open to, you know, interpretation. But it's important to know that the police think that it makes sense in their suicide theory.
It is, because I'm sure they looked at the terrain and then what was actually physically found on the sleeping bag itself. Still strange about the pants, though. They're going a couple different directions with it. Obviously, the main one is suicide, but a couple different directions on why, right? They have the recreational drug usage mixed with alcohol. And then they also have maybe one person that could say he was a little bit depressed.
It was a female friend that was one of the people that saw him that night. But she said that night he didn't seem depressed, but in the past he had talked about being depressed and had, you know, thought about ending his life. No one else had ever heard anything like that before. And what's interesting about her statement is that she claims that it happened over Christmas break when Damien, she says, did not go home to Texas and stayed home and was kind of stayed in Colorado and was kind of depressed. Yeah. And that's whenever he said he thought about killing himself. What's interesting to me is that Damien did go home for Christmas that holiday and had a plane ticket that his family had purchased months in advance and was home with his family for like a 10-day period, which is pretty normal with kids in college. So it makes me question her memory of that event. It is certainly something that deserves attention and deserves consideration. But of the 47 interviews that were conducted, she was the one person who said Damien had talked about suicide before. Now, granted, things that are hard to talk about, things that are difficult, you know, we don't talk to everybody about the deepest, darkest thoughts that we ever have. The idea that he wouldn't have shared it with everyone, you know, does make sense. But this one person in particular, from what I can gather, a pretty casual acquaintance, it was surprising to me that would be the person that he would reveal that to if he did indeed, you know, say those things. But it's a point in the investigation that, you know, you have to consider and mark down and think about, you know, as a possibility. But like every other witness, you have to question their believability and their, you know, if you choose to take that witness, you know, as something to build your case on, or if you think it's something that's not relevant. You know, she was someone that I definitely was curious about and was interested in. I wish police had recorded their first interview with her. Really strange. You know, they had their initial interview with her, apparently said all these things for the first time in her own words, but they didn't record that. And then the second interview is basically the police officer regurgitating it, saying it in his words and telling her, that's what you said, right? You said this, you know, and then she's like, yeah, yeah. But you don't actually hear it from her because that first call wasn't recorded. So all of it was a little strange to me, but I did find it interesting. And I was intrigued to know that there was actually one person who thought that Damien was suicidal.
It's not uncommon to kind of feel that way when you're in college. I'm not saying suicidal, but some sort of little bit of depression when you're away from home for what probably was the first time ever for an extended amount of time. Definitely relate to that as far as maybe a little bit of depression, but that's obviously a major step to take. I could talk about this all day. I really could. There's a few more strange things though with the phone. I'm going to let you touch up on that, because I know some people said there were text messages that, and even the dad said there were some messages that were not even found on the phone, but he had on his phone that he could show.
So a couple of points about the phone that are interesting. Number one, Damian's text message that he sent to Anthony Rios, inviting him to the party at the wrestler's house and essentially inviting him to fight. Those text messages are not on Damian's phone whenever it's found by police. They only know that they exist because Anthony comes to the police department and shows them his phone. And they take pictures of the text messages from Damian to Anthony on Anthony's phone. But those records do not exist on Damian's phone. There's no text message thread between Anthony and Damian. The Gunnison police even went and got the original records from Sprint, and they can't find that text message. So it's very bizarre that it wouldn't be there. Those text messages, if not for Anthony's phone, we wouldn't even know what they said or when he sent them. The other thing about the phone that's interesting is that it's disassembled and sitting on the passenger side seat of Damian's car when police find it. So the phone itself, the battery's been removed, the case has been removed, and there's also a blue bandana that's sitting on the seat next to the disassembled phone, sort of wrapped up in the items. It's a strange scene. You look at it and it definitely is not what you expect to find, you know, in someone's car. And there's even a screwdriver set that appears to have been recently purchased because it's still mostly packaged, and it's lying on the floorboard of the passenger side seat. It's been opened and there's some items removed from it. And actually the backside of Damian's phone is down on the floorboard, touching this partially opened used screwdriver set. It all, you know, paints a picture of someone disassembling that phone in Damian's car, possibly using those screwdrivers, or and what did they use the bandana for? We've discussed the possibility they might have wiped down the phone with it because there were no fingerprints found on the phone, except for one latent print on the face of the phone that's never been able to be identified.
Still involved with 48 hours and that. So essentially, this is just really proves your dedication to it, because you also have a full-time thing that you're doing, and you had you found the time to do this.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why it took me so long. It took me about 3 years to do the podcast, because I was doing it while at the same time, working full-time as a development producer and field producer for 48 hours. So going to trials, traveling all over the country, you know, producing shoots. Yeah, it's been a crazy time, but it's so nice to have it out in the world and to know that it is possible to have, you know, your passion project and keep your day job. So that's been good. And I'll have a second season that'll come out in 2023, you know, through Podcast One as well. And then we'll see what happens from there, but it'll be on a completely different case. It won't be Damian's case. So,
and this is just a great story. You can find the podcast Final Days on Earth really anywhere. And correct. What about website wise? I'll let you share that information as well.
Yeah. So you can go to finaldaysonearth.com and find out more about the podcast. And I have a blog where I put some interesting documents and things on there. You can always find the latest episode there. But yeah, whatever podcast platform you use, you can find Final Days on Earth there.
And we want as many people as possible to listen to this and hear about this story.
Yes, please. Yeah, I'm receiving lots of tips through my website. I have a secure contact form. So I've gotten a lot of really good information. You know, my great hope for Damian's case is that people are going to come forward that provide the information and the closure to his family that, you know, they've been looking for ever since 2014. And I believe that the answers are out there and that people, you know, will come forward and provide them as sort of a matter of time and of knowing, you know, the story and how they fit into it. I think a lot of times people, you know, you don't know what you've seen or what you've heard, you know, and until you know the bigger story, that there's something else, you know, going on in the background. So, you know, I'm really hopeful that someone will come forward and finally have these answers that everyone's been looking for.
Really, truly, thank you for spending this time doing this interview today. I really mean it. Like I said, I really hope everybody listening looks into this case, because it, like so many others, deserve answers. Thank you, Claire. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Really do appreciate you listening to this episode and checking it out. I hope you continue to do so with the next. I hope you have an appreciation for what I'm trying to do here. Highlight all the different things all sorts of different creators are doing. I hope you get behind me on that and continue to join me on my journey. I'm Podcast Father, the Indie Podcaster.
See you next time.